From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Race rebels and the Olympics. Today we'll look at athletes who run for their country and stand up for their people. From Aboriginal sprinter Kathy Freeman, Sydney 2000, to John Carlos and Tommy Smith, Mexico City, 1968. They'll tell us about that day when they thrust their black glove fists in the air as the U.S. national anthem was being played. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. First, these news headlines. President Clinton said yesterday he'd long been troubled by the treatment of nuclear weapons scientist Wen-Ho Lee, even as Attorney General Janet Reno defended her department's handling of the case. Clinton told reporters he was concerned by the way federal prosecutors blocked bail for the Taiwanese-born Lee, who was held in solitary confinement for 9 months in New Mexico before his release on Wednesday under a plea agreement. He was often held in shackles with lights in his cell 24 hours a day, not allowed to speak in his native tongue, seeing his family only 1 hour a week. Lee was initially portrayed as a spy for China, though these allegations were unproven and no formal espionage charges were ever filed. Lee was arrested last December on 59 counts of illegally copying design secrets, to which he pleaded not guilty. Clinton said, "I always had reservations about the claims that were being made denying him bail." The president said he and others at the White House had taken in good faith the claims federal prosecutors were making against Lee that he could not be freed on bail because he was a danger to national security. The president went on to say, "All of a sudden they reach a plea agreement which will, if anything, make his alleged offense look modest compared to the claims that were made against him. So the whole thing was quite troubling to me." Earlier in the day, Attorney General Janet Reno defended the Justice Department's handling of the matter and said Lee himself was responsible for his long imprisonment. The Attorney General said, "I think Dr. Lee had the opportunity from the beginning to resolve this matter, and he chose not to, and I think he must look to himself." Reno refused to apologize. Three Dutch men and an American heading for the Czech Republic to demonstrate against International Monetary Fund and World Bank policies were not allowed to enter the Czech Republic today. The activists who were traveling from the Netherlands via Germany carrying a mobile kitchen for demonstrators were stopped by the Czech foreigner police at the Hrensko border crossing in North Bohemia. Another man was denied access to the country at three Czech-Austrian border crossings Tuesday evening. A Czech Greenpeace spokesperson said the activists who took part in a demonstration against the activation of the nuclear power station Temelin in July plan to demonstrate against Temelin in front of the government office in Prague today. This news from Britain. Britain has urged Colombia to improve its human rights record before it's willing to finance an international plan to stamp out drug production. The appeal came from a British cabinet minister, Mo Mollem, on a visit to Bogota, during which she met the Colombian president, Andres Pastrana. Mollem said that while progress was being made on the issue of human rights violations, there was a long way to go before Britain or its European Union partners would release funds for what is known as Plan Colombia. The United States has given $1.3 billion to Colombia, mainly in military aid. Ms. Mollem said Britain was concerned that large-scale crop spraying intended to eradicate illegal coca plantations could poison people living nearby. Similar concerns have been raised in neighboring Peru. On Wednesday, the authorities in Lima announced they'd reinforced security along the border with Colombia to prevent any spillover from the counter-narcotics offensive. The Clinton administration soon will provide $4 million to political foes of Iraqi President Saddam Hussein to help them try to end his rule, this according to a senior State Department official. Congress was notified of the grant recently, and another $4 million will be sent in stages under a program being worked out with the Iraqi National Congress, which is trying to oust the Iraqi leader. Some 200 Iraqi dissidents are being schooled with Pentagon funds on legal and war crime issues. The U.S. contributions are to be used to fund a newspaper, radio transmitters, and other media operations. An American man of Italian descent has been executed in the United States in spite of appeals for clemency from the Italian Prime Minister and Pope John Paul. Derek Rocco Barnabé was killed by lethal injection in the state of Virginia for raping and murdering his 17-year-old girlfriend. The United States Supreme Court had turned down two appeals hours beforehand. And after a week of long-distance sparring, representatives of Vice President Gore and Texas Governor George Bush met for the first time yesterday and agreed to a series of three presidential debates and one vice presidential debate beginning October 3rd in Boston.
It's not what you think. No, no, no. It's not what you're thinking. No, no, no. It's not what you think. Say no, baby, no, 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 baby, yes, not what you think. Say no, baby, no, 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 baby, that's the way you swing. Say no, baby, no, 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 baby, it's not what you're thinking. It's not what you think. No, 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 it's not what you're thinking, baby. No, 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 it's not what you think. No, baby, no, 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 baby, it's not what you think. Say no, baby, no, 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 baby, that's the way you swing. Say no, baby, no, 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 baby, it's not what you think. It's not what you think. No, 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 it's not what you think. No, 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 it's not what you think.
It's not what you think.
No, baby, no, 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 baby,
it's
not what you think. Say no, baby, no.
The Aboriginal Australian group, the Stiffgins, from their CD, Sofa. Here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Good day, Amy, and to our listeners all around the country.
It's good to have you with us, Juan, and you have an important story in today's New York Daily News.
Well, I have a column that deals with the situation, continuing problems between the United States and Cuba. The Ricardo Alarcón, who was the president of the National Assembly of Cuba and who was here for the Millennium Summit along with Fidel Castro, was scheduled to go to Washington this week to participate in the annual Congressional Black Caucus events that would culminate in Saturday night's big gala dinner that the caucus always has for thousands of African Americans from around the country. But at the last moment, he was denied permission by the State Department to travel to Washington, D.C., despite the protests of Congressman Charles Rangel and many others in the Black Caucus who personally wrote to the president and asked him for the permission. They were worried, apparently, that Alarcón was getting ready to cement this proposal that the Cuban government and Fidel Castro have issued to train 500 Americans in Cuban medical schools, African Americans and Latinos, who cannot afford to go to medical school in the United States. Cuba is offering to train 500 of them a year so that they can return to work in underserved communities of the United States. And for Congressman Benny Thompson, who is the who went to Cuba early this year and worked out the original idea with Castro, he's from the Delta, the Mississippi Delta, the poorest state in the Union, where his constituents have to travel an hour and a half to see a doctor. And many in the Black Caucus are really fired up by the possibility of adding all of these new African American and Latino doctors to the United States core of doctors. But the State Department, apparently, since President Clinton is expected to be at the dinner, and in all likelihood Vice President Gore would be there, didn't want to have to confront the possibility of having the number two leader of Cuba breaking bread with them at the Congressional Black Caucus dinner. So they denied him permission to travel and to announce this new initiative.
It's interesting. I don't think people realize that with people like Cuban President Fidel Castro, and there are few like him when it comes to U.S. law, they don't allow him or his party, which included Ricardo Alarcón, and Castro talked about this at the big Harlem event last week, outside of a 25-mile radius from the United Nations that allowed him to go to Harlem, but not further. He
right,
also
but
said
interestingly,
that
the State Department did grant visas to 6 members of the Cuban National Assembly, lower-ranking members, to go to Washington, but did not grant it to a high-profile figure like Alarcón.
And they also made it difficult even for the whole group, Alarcón and Castro in particular, to come to the U.S., giving them something around 28 hours' notice on their visa, saying it would be not denied until then. Well, we're going to move into the main topic of today's show, which is the Sydney Olympics. Just in the last few hours, Australian Olympic sprinter Cathy Freeman lit the cauldron that signifies the beginning of the 2000 Olympic Summer Games. Cathy Freeman is an Aboriginal athlete who became a household name after she wrapped herself in the Aboriginal flag rather than the Australian flag when she did her lap of honor at the 1994 Canadian Commonwealth Games. Today, Cathy Freeman is Australia's best chance for a track gold medal. But interestingly enough, she is also partly the reason why so many major marches have been planned for the Sydney Olympics, inspired by her most recent public comments when she told a London newspaper earlier this summer that the government was, quote, insensitive for refusing to apologize for the lost generation of stolen children. She then admitted that her grandmother had been a stolen child. She said, "You have a government that's so insensitive to the issues that are close to the people's hearts, that have affected so many lives for the worse. People are going to be really angry and emotional." Part of that emotion can be seen in Freeman's shoes, which have been dyed to match the red, black, and gold of the Aboriginal flag. Another part will be seen if Freeman wins the 400, after which she's expected once again to run a victory lap waving that flag. We're going to go now to Sydney, Australia, to speak with Kim Bullimore. She's an Aboriginal organizer with the Indigenous Student Network, as well as the Democratic Socialist Party in Sydney. We'll speak with her more later in the program after we talk with two other race rebels, John Carlos and Tommy Smith, well known for their very significant act in Mexico City Olympic Games 1968. But for now, Kim Bullimore, can you tell us about what just happened in the last hours, Cathy Freeman lighting the cauldron?
Yes, the opening ceremony went for about 3.5 hours, and in the last leg of it, a series of Australian women athletes brought the flame in for the last leg, and Cathy lit the flame as the final person.
Can you tell us about Cathy Freeman?
Well, Cathy Freeman's very well known in the Aboriginal community in the sense that she's a very high-profile Aboriginal athlete, and I suppose she's been seen as, in many ways, the pride of the Aboriginal athletic community and in general that, and she's also been adopted very much by the rest of the Australian community as well.
Did she suffer any repercussions after her her protest at the past Olympics?
There was a lot of discussion, and you know, there was condemnation that came from certain areas of the Australian community and also within the athletic community. But I think on the whole, a great many of us Australians, both obviously Indigenous and non-Indigenous, actually did support the fact that she did carry the Aboriginal flag with her. And I suppose that was one of the first times that an Indigenous athlete has been so prominent about actually displaying the Aboriginal colours. So there was a little bit of backlash from more conservative areas, but on the whole, I think most people supported what she did.
The Sydney Olympics just opening now. They're putting a multicultural face on the whole event using Aboriginal myth and music, as well as brightly colored costume migrant communities to open the ceremonies. And yet there is major protest as well.
Yes, that's correct. Probably the main thing that protesters, Indigenous and non-Indigenous, bring up is the fact that, you know, while it's absolutely fantastic that, you know, Cathy Freeman is part of the overall Australian community and the government and various other, you know, elite groups within, you know, sporting world and things like that are willing to, you know, adopt Kathy, and the Indigenous community thinks that's really fantastic. The problem is that unfortunately, a lot of Aboriginal culture is taken on and adopted by, say, the Australian government or other governmental organisations, but there's still a lot of other things that don't happen. Excuse me, sorry, it's been a very long day. Don't happen is because things like, you know, Indigenous health is the worst in Australia. There's also high rates of incarceration. There's low levels of education and things like these. And these questions are often pushed to the background. And so I suppose it's the dichotomy between the two that that myself and other Indigenous activists like to point out, the fact that you can't adopt, say, athletes like Kathy Freeman and the Aboriginal culture, but then refuse to actually, you know, look at the problems that are faced by the Aboriginal community and refuse to do anything about it.
Well, Kim Ballymore, we're going to come back to you in Sydney, Australia, in a little while, but we wanted to go back in time first. As you talk about Kathy Freeman, we're going to go back to one of America's defining moments, made at the 1968 Olympic Games in Mexico. They were the most controversial and highest Olympics ever held, staged at 7,349 feet above sea level, where the thin air was a major concern to many competing countries. The Mexico City Olympics were buffeted by the Vietnam War, the Democratic Convention in Chicago, the Soviet invasion of Czechoslovakia. The U.S. civil rights movement was grappling with the aftermath of the assassination of Martin Luther King. 10 days before the Olympics were scheduled to open, scores of Mexico City University students were killed by army troops. Officials at the Olympic Games managed to quell any disruption until two African Americans, Tommy Smith and John Carlos, who finished first and third in the 200-meter run, bowed their heads and, at great personal risk to themselves, raised their fists in the Black Power salute during the national anthem. We're joined right now by John Carlos and Tommy Smith. Welcome to Democracy Now!
It's great to be alive. It's great to be with you today.
Well, Tommy Smith, I'd like to ask you, as you hear the what is going on in Australia right now in terms of the protests of the Aboriginal community there during the opening of the Sydney Games, what reflections does it bring to mind to you?
First of all, good morning, John.
Morning, Tommy.
And one, I think. There's troubles all over the world, and we, John, and I, sitting here knowing what's going on around the world in part, but we're sitting here. I think we should be over there to listen and to deal with the situation there. You call us here, well, yet and still, the world is in peril, so you call John and Tommy to find out what's going on. To me, it hasn't changed a whole lot. That is Australia, and I'm not an Australian, either Indigenous or non-Indigenous pupil. So troubles will arise. So I have really no answer for that, but problems will be, as long as there's man, there will be problems.
In 1968, can you tell us what went into the protest that you staged as you were getting your award, standing up for the United States? Describe the scene.
John
Carlos.
What can I say? We had a very... First of all, let me start off by saying I commend Kathy Freeman for her stance for her people, as well as the representation of her country. Going back to your original question.
Right. Remember, there may be some young people who are listening right now who weren't even born when you were involved in this protest.
Well, let me try and give them a picture. We had a stadium roughly 85,000 people in it. I think they were very pretentious in terms of what might happen based on previous conversations about possible Olympic boycotts or demonstrations. The Olympic Committee, the International Olympic Committee, as well as the United States Olympic Committee, tried to quell any type of demonstration or any type of conversation of demonstration. And they did a pretty fair job, because they pretty much intimidated a lot of athletes. They pretty much tried to bribe athletes in terms of saying we can get you a job with this corporation, or we can make you a movie star, or we can make you a football player. In other words, if you be a good boy, we're going to put you on easy street. A lot of people felt that. A lot of people felt that the medal was far more important than any type of demonstration.
Hold this thought, because we have to break for stations to identify themselves. John Carlos and Tommy Smith are our guests. They're the African-American athletes in 1968 who put their fists up in the Black Power salute when the U.S. National Anthem was being played, and they were being bestowed with the highest athletic honors in the world as they won in the 1968 Mexico City Olympics. You're listening to Pacific Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back with them in 1 minute. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Our guests are John Carlos and Tommy Smith. They are well known for the picture that went around the world, Mexico City, 1968, as they were being given the first and third honors, medals for the 200-meter run as they bowed their heads and raise their fists in the Black Power salute during the national anthem as a protest against racism in the U.S. John Carlos, you were just setting the scene for us.
Right, and as I said, at that particular time, with all the hype of the Olympics, Tommy Smith and John Carlos got together as two young men and felt that it was the right time in society for someone to instill some sort of shock therapy to society and let them know that the social qualms that we have here in the United States, as well as around the world, people needed to focus and pay a little more attention to the issues. So we decided that it was necessary that we would carry on and do something anyway other than just run and represent America on the track and raise the flag. We wanted to be a little like Kathy Freeman in terms of saying we're concerned about the little people in the world. And we got together. And as you see, we've gone to the victory stand. We hid our gloves in our pants. And when we got out to the stands and they began to play the national anthem after we received our medals, then we brought the gloves out of our pants and actually thrust them towards the sky. John Carlos in particular, I put my fist to the sky in defiance of what was happening to poor people in the United States and around the world. And I did it rather defiantly based on the fact that, you know, I felt that this is something that God wanted us to do. I feel that it was a divine effort on Tommy and John's part.
And what was the reaction first of your fellow Olympic team members and then later on of the general public in the months after that to your protest?
Tommy, you dropped that one.
The actions of Tommy Smith and John Carlos then were a surprise to everyone. Most people thought that athletes at that particular time, especially black athletes, could not think unless spoken to first with a thought of reoccurrence. We, at that particular time, had something to do, as John said, and it was given to us to do on a world's platform. It was a shock to people, and the aftermath of athletes on our team were surprised as well as the rest of the world. It was very organized movement of the black athletes of the 19th Olympiad in Mexico City. Meetings started years before. We've had a meeting only a few days before victory stand, and of course each athlete, as the meeting indicated of the black athletes just before, that each athlete would act according to his or her feelings toward the nation that we were living in. So it was a surprise to everybody because of its quietness and the conductivity of the athletes in those meetings. It was a decision of the athletes and not the Olympic Committee.
Well, you know, it's been now 32 years since that protest. A lot has happened in this country, and certainly in the world of sports. African Americans now and in sports like football or in basketball are dominant in the sport as and substantially in baseball. But have you seen much change in the general society in terms of some of the issues or questions that you were protesting against then?
Time will always have a change. Time will always make a change. We're talking about the mentality of people within that change, which the almighty dollar has made a change. I think the change of the pride and the effect has been more negative than positive toward the freedoms, toward the actions of people who are fighting for human rights. Of course, time has changed. 32 years. You look at me and John, and you'll see that John and I have changed too. But I do believe the minds of Tommy Smith and John Carlos has not gone off into the red in thinking that things have overwhelmingly changed because of what we did. We sacrificed, as a lot of people have sacrificed. Some rule, some don't rule.
In 1994, when Kathy Freeman did her victory lap wrapped in the Aboriginal flag, she was shunned by a lot of Australia. And for years, she didn't make another political statement. I think it surprised many this summer when just before these games, and she's considered Australia's best bet for an Olympic track medal, she made these political comments about how her people are being treated. What happened to both of you after you put your hands up in the Black Power salute? I mean, obviously, you were star athletes. You had won the first and some of the highest medals in all of at the Olympic Games.
First, I'd like to say that Kathy Freeman was shunned prior to her going to the Olympic Games or prior to her taking part in sports. She was shunned just based on her ethnicity. Tommy Smith and John Carlos, as many blacks or most blacks in the United States, were being shunned. Only time that we're recognized is if we go to war and we put our lives and our blood on the line, and then when we come back home, we're shunned. When we go into battle, into sports, we're recognized and honored as long as we behave. When we come back home, we're shunned until the next time the flag is raised or next time the war is raised. We are looking for equality as human beings. Based on what Kathy Freeman did, based on what Tommy Smith and John Carlos did, we were individuals that God appointed to be icons for the poor. So relative to what the United States did, they didn't do any more than what they did to black people all over the world. Close us out from employment, close us out from fair living conditions, slandered our kids in school, had many of our friends to step away from us, to have us even at one time or another look at ourselves and see whether we were right in what we did, just based on the fact that all the commotion was about a very nonviolent activity that took place to educate society.
And that's what John says. America is a very strong country, and he has his people under his thumb most of the time, and those people won't reveal their feelings because the loss they feel that would be forthcoming if they would do that. It's called a sacrifice when you stand up for a right, when you stand up for a feeling, when you stand up for a meaning. And that's why John Carlos and Tommy Smith went through and still going through what we had, because the people are afraid to stand up for those people who are really sacrificing for their benefit.
Well, John Carlos, the Olympics have been under increasing scrutiny over corruption scandals on the Olympic Organizing Committee. There's increasing commercialization of amateur sports. What is your view of the impact of all of this corporate dominance of amateur sports and sports in general in America?
Well, as Tommy said, times have changed. And, you know, the flame, the Olympic flame used to be burned off of gas or coal. Now the Olympic flame is burned off of dollar bills, $1,000 bills, $1 million bills, and so forth like that. This is why, you know, there's so much drugs in the Olympics now in terms of the athletes using various drug enhancements to affect their performance, based on the fact that there is a large percentage of money involved, not only for the athlete himself, but for that country and overall for the International Olympic Committee. So this is why the drug system is going on the way it's gone. This is why world records have been fought on, like people just dropping change out of their pockets. You know, Tommy is the best in the world ever. When you sit back and you look at Tommy Smith, Tommy can tell you what it takes to break a world record. If as great as Tommy Smith was, or Bob Hayes, or Wilma Rudolph, they know what it takes to break world records, and they know it wasn't a thing that you can go out and break a world record every time you hit the track. And this is what's happening with these young individuals. I'm not naive about it, and I don't think that the Olympic Committee nor the U.S. Olympic Committee is naive about it as well. So therefore, you have to say that times have changed. You know, individuals say now, well, you know, steroids is the thing of the day, and we should accept it if it's going to help the kid enhance his performance, then I don't see anything wrong with it. Well, I'll tell you right away that the steroids of today are killing young athletes. They don't put it in the news. They don't expel upon that as much as they should. If you think about Lyle Alzado, the football player, when he was playing football, he took drugs and steroids and enhancements to make his performance better as he was dying. He made a special video, he and his wife, to tell kids this is taboo, stay away from it. As soon as Lyle Alzado died, they never mentioned Lyle Alzado. They never mentioned that video. They never mentioned what he said about steroids or poison. So it's almost like these individuals are being duped into taking these drugs. They're being duped into, you know, shooting for the goal, so to speak. And when I say the goal, it's not the same goal that Tommy Smith or John Collins were shooting for. They're shooting for the goal in the sky. They give individuals at championship events gold bullion. That's telling you right there. Do whatever is necessary to do to come out of the ghettos now and be our stars, because now we're feeding you as an individual. We're not feeding your race, but we will feed you.
John Carlos, Tommy Smith, Olympic winners of 1968, became a symbol of protest and militancy for another generation. Did you go on in sports? What specifically did each of you have you done in these 32 years? Were you able?
After the games, during those times, John Carlos, Tommy Smith were into the social issues of families, and we had families, and we could not run and train the way we train without substances, without human element help. We had to help ourselves in terms of finance. We had to get jobs. Plus, we were typically banned from any international and national competition by the USOC because they didn't have the information that they wanted before the victory stand, so they could tell the world what these boys were going to do, as Avery Brundage labeled us so frequently as boys. So we had the life to continue the best way we possibly could, since the system did not help.
We were ostracized. You know what? A lack of money brings contempt into anyone's household. They broke up our families. We were not able to give our kids what kids should have in terms of being prepared for school. We couldn't buy school paper for our kids. We couldn't buy books. A lot of times we didn't have clothes for our kids. I recall living in my house at one time, having to chop my furniture up and throw my furniture in the furnace and then the fireplace, and have my family sleep around the fireplace in order for us just to stay warm, because I didn't have money to pay my electric bill. I didn't have money to buy food for my kids. I had to go out and be subjected to women that liked me, you know, to stay with them, to have money to feed my wife, to feed my kids. It wasn't the right thing to do, but it was a necessary thing to do. I recall they would send letters to my wife and take pictures if I went around to various universities to give speeches. They were trying to break the divide in my household, which they accomplished. But yet and still, as I said, God is good, and we're alive and well and here today to tell the world, yes, we still stand strongly behind what we did in 1968. We feel that things have changed relatively slow in this society, but yet and still I think more people are starting to wake up to the fact that this is an issue that they need to discuss. And we need to get by the discussion portion and move ahead and start making the changes.
You know, it reminds me of Rosa Parks. Everyone looks at her individual act as if it came out of nowhere. In fact, she was very disciplined, had been basically, in a sense, training for years to do what she did. She was an organized, nonviolent protester. I don't think a lot of people realize that what you did in 1968 was part of what was called the 1968 Revolt of the Black Athlete, and that it was actually a project, the Olympic Project for Human Rights. Of course, you had to decide whether or not you were going to do it to the last second, I mean, before the world, to stand up, knowing what you would face. But
well, I don't think that we decided the last second that we were going to do something. I think that we knew we were going to do something as strongly as various individuals felt that Olympic medal was more important than life itself. I always felt that we were going to do something. As a question as to what we were going to do. We wanted to do something that would be very strong, very pungent, but very nonviolent at the same time.
What was the crowd response?
Well, the crowd response showed joy and jubilation when we went out there, because here we are, these same niggas that are out here winning medals for us. And then after we won the medals and we went as men to do the demonstration, that changed instantaneously from love and admiration to hate and vinegar. You know, just it was just raw hate, and no love whatsoever. Just merely based on the fact that we were two young black individuals that did it and put a black glove on our hand. You would think that we had bullets across our chest and we had hand grenades that we threw off into the crowd. So it was like, if you're black or a person of color, don't step out of the circle because you have no right. I've seen white athletes do various things here in the United States and around the world that have never been penalized and always have been overlooked and actually had made excuses about why they did or why they didn't do various things.
What is the sense of either of you in terms of the current African-American athletes and their relationship to the ongoing struggles of the day for equality? Are you seeing some athletes that are taking strong roles, or do you feel that many of them are succumbing to the money and the fame? I know, for instance, Michael Jordan was under a lot of pressure over his relationship to Nike and the sweatshops around the world.
Well, you know, you could look back in time and say, you know, I think in the 60s, I think that the athletes of that era were politically inclined. We were historians in terms of knowing our history, the wrongs that have been done. And I think there was a focus, there was an energy in terms of becoming aware, pushing back the sand to read our history. I think today that's not prevalent. Individuals don't know too much about their history. They don't care to know that much about their history. And they want to be black, but yet and still they want to make that almighty dollar. That's more important than actually saying, hey, you know, there's people in my community that admire me, respect me, and love me for my deeds on the athletic field. But I think that I owe them some sort of responsibility, too. That comes from within yourself being educated about what happened before you and what you would like to see happen after you. Once these young athletes of today wake up to this, I think they will start to cast their feelings and thoughts about what's happening to society and what's happening to their race within the society.
We're going to end with you, Tommy Smith, gold medal winner. Final comment.
I'm with athletes every day, and the athletes are not interested in going out doing something for less than. They look at Tommy Smith as a person. First of all, 99.999% of my athletes don't know who Tommy Smith is because of the educational facilities in this country. It was something negative, and it's not pointed to a positive direction. Now, you asked me to straighten that out. Well, as an educator, a lot of things he's doing to straighten that out. Now, what I'm doing right now in my classes are not going up teaching hate, only teaching the educational process of what the country is about.
What are you doing right now?
I'm an instructor. I'm a college instructor, college coach. I thought you would know that by now since you called me and want to talk to me about these
but
things.
Why don't you tell the listeners where you're working?
I work at a college in California. I've taught sociology at the college, also teaching health, and I'm the head track and field coach there. I've been there for 22 years, and I've done things with my people, with my athletes, on an educational basis. Even the instructors there haven't the slightest idea of my teachings or where I'm from. So it's educational situation we're talking about here, not just people in one country or people in another country. We're talking about a world situation. The ignorance of this country is astounding, because it only teaches things that make up people think negative about their surroundings. The communities, I've listened to the news last night, all the atrocities that's happening. If we were to talk more positively about who we are, where we are, what we're doing, I think the nation would be much better. But the nation would have to understand that those people who sacrifice need a type of social indulgence in needs of others also.
Well,
I don't believe that the country of this size should have problems as that we are having because everybody have problems. It's not the people, it's those who are running the people.
On that note, I want to thank you both very much for being with us. John Carlos, Tommy Smith.
Tommy, call me. Let's get together. You better believe it, John, because if we don't, they're going to try to tear us apart.
No, let's get together, man. Let's get the wife down here. Let's have a good time, man.
Okay, John, I'll give you a call.
All right, baby. Later.
Thank you. And Tommy Smith, teaching at Santa Monica College. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, a T-shirt of the photograph of Tommy Smith and John Carlos with their fists up and the Black Power salute as they had just been given the gold and bronze medal for their runs. Under it is the saying, if you don't stand for something, you'll fall for anything. You're listening to Pacific Radio's Democracy Now! We'll go back to Sydney, Australia in just a minute. The didgeridoo, an Aboriginal instrument. We'll find out whether it was played at the opening ceremonies of the Summer Olympics that just took place in Sydney, Australia, hours ago, as the world watched a spectacular show of lights, music, and dance telling the story of Australia's history, or one version of it anyway. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez, and we continue to look at this opening day of the Olympics. Sydney putting on its best multicultural face using traditional Aboriginal myth and music, as well as brightly costumed migrant communities of color in the opening ceremony. While the corporate-sponsored gala was taking place, Indigenous people, migrants, students, and anti-globalization activists were mobilizing in many different parts of Sydney to voice their dissent. Aborigines taking advantage of the international media spotlight to show the world how they've been stripped of their land, denied their culture, had their children taken away, and most recently been refused an apology by the Prime Minister. This is Kathy Freeman, Australia's best hope for a track medal, called on the Australian government to apologize. We go to Sydney now with Kim Bullimore, Aboriginal organizer with the Indigenous Student Network. Also joining us, Joel Bray, with that same Indigenous Student Network, and Damien Lawson with the Western Suburbs Legal Center in Melbourne. Kim Bullimore, as you listen to John Carlos and Tommy Smith, your thoughts about Kathy Freeman and what you're doing in the streets for these games?
I have to admit I did agree with what both John and Tommy were saying about the appropriation of athletes and, you know, Indigenous culture and things like that, as I was mentioning before, that that a lot of the times the wider community seems happy to take on those particular aspects of Aboriginal culture and our athletes and people of high profile, but at a lot of the time there is also a willingness to sweep under the carpet the issues that are affecting Indigenous Australians as one of the most disadvantaged social groups in the country. So that is can be quite a contradiction in the way Indigenous Australians are treated, and I thought both Tommy and John were spot on in what they were saying in that particular aspect.
Well, I'd like to ask Damien Lawson with the Western Suburbs Legal Center. First of all, welcome to Democracy Now! Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can. It's great to be on the show, and pretty awesome to come after those amazing athletes and activists you were just talking to.
Well, I'd like to ask you about the security preparations for the Olympics. There's everything from Black Hawk helicopters, New South Wales State Police, tens of thousands of private security guards and volunteers who have the power to search and detain people, and floating just offshore some U.S. warships. Now, some people, of course, would say you need this kind of security measure given the history of some Olympics, like the Munich Olympics and also the bombings in Atlanta in when the Olympics were held there recently. But what is the reaction of ordinary Australians to this immense security?
Oh, look, there's certainly been an increasing level of concern as we've got closer and closer to the Olympics. In fact, there's just been a very high-profile campaign by huge numbers of Australians against the Labor Party, which is like the Democrats in America, and the Liberal Party, which are something like the Republicans, support for new powers for the military to be used as police.
Just to understand, is it true that federal troops have shoot-to-kill orders?
They certainly, the new legislation which was just passed last week after one of the longest debates in federal parliamentary history in Australia, enables the federal government to order out the troops onto the street with a whole range of police powers, but including the power to shoot to kill in certain instances.
Hmm. And what was, I understand that, well, before Sydney, you're in Melbourne, and there was the World Economic Congress, the first series of protests. What was the response?
Well, it was amazing, absolutely amazing protest. I was down there being a legal observer and supporting the activists down there, and they effectively closed down the forum on the first day by blockading every entrance to the forum, similar to Seattle. And the response over the next 2 days was ferocious by the police. They beat hundreds of protesters. Hundreds of protesters were injured. Many of them are still in hospital. It was absolutely incredible, and I think it really showed up this move towards what we're describing as the paramilitarism amongst the police force. Police are becoming more like the military.
Well, and I don't think anyone heard about this.
Exactly. That was my reaction. Very, almost no mention of that in the American press, although I'm sure that in the circles of power here in the United States, everyone is probably aware of what happened, but none of the major media in this country gave what happened there any attention.
The protests were specifically, what was that body doing? What were they closing down?
The World Economic Forum is a private, non-government organization made up of the richest 1,000 corporations in the world. They usually meet every year in Davos in Switzerland. This year they're having a special meeting in Melbourne as part of what's been billed by the Foreign Minister of Australia as the Business Olympics. And Bill Gates was there. I mean, the richest man in the world was there, along with many, many other CEOs and heads of government.
So he goes from Seattle to Melbourne.
That's right, and it's not the same as the WTO, but in many ways it's definitely involved in developing the free trade agenda of the global multinationals. It claims to have started the Uruguay round of the GATT, which led to the WTO. So it's a very significant body, and as a result, protesters from right across the spectrum got together and managed to blockade it and seriously disrupt it and shut it down for at least a day.
Well, today, several thousand Aborigines marched in Sydney, some from as far away as 2,000 miles. One demonstration formed a human chain along the road outside the Sydney airport. Another act of protest was the celebration of a traditional Aboriginal ceremony, which was held at the so-called Aboriginal Tent Embassy in downtown Sydney. Another group camped at Botany Bay, where Captain James Cook supposedly discovered Australia in 1770. Also, demonstrations against some of the world's largest multinationals on board as Olympic sponsors like Nike, McDonald's, Coca-Cola. Joel Bray, you're with the Indigenous Student Network. Where were you today?
Well, I actually went down to the Aboriginal Tent Embassy.
Can you describe it to us?
Yeah, the Tent Embassy actually has a long history. It's almost 30 years old this year, and it has come up from our capital city, Canberra, and has pitched itself virtually in the middle of the Olympic city this year. And it's nothing more than a bunch of tents in a park, and so it looks very ordinary, you know, with banners and stuff. But it has enormous symbolic importance in Australia, because it has always been a site of shame and embarrassment for a government which has a people who are so alienated within their own country that they feel they have to have an embassy. So I was down there for the ceremony today, and we also marched as a demonstration into the centre of town and protested outside of both the State Parliament House and also the offices of our Prime Minister.
This whole issue of the taking away of Aboriginal children by the government of Australia, could you tell us a little bit about that? Because the I know Native Americans had similar problems in the late 19th century when thousands of Native American children here in this country were taken from their families and sent to boarding schools supposedly to be Americanized, and had an enormously destructive impact on the many of the Native American nations. But when did this occur, and how extensive was it? Kim Bullimore, could you tell us about that?
The Stolen Generations refers to not just, you know, one generation of people. It's actually was an ongoing long-term policy, which basically in effect really took place from the moment of colonization in 1788. But probably the primary period that it did happen was from the late 1890s to up to as late as the 1960s in Australia. And basically it was what's known under the White Australia policy and also the assimilation policy, which was basically the theory, the social Darwinist theory, that, you know, Aboriginal people, as many other Indigenous groups around the world, were of a dying race. And so the best thing was to do was actually breed the race out. And so what happened was children, usually who may have been of lighter skin, would be taken from their families, separated, and either sent into domestic situations or homes, like boarding school type things, where they would basically become slaves, because they were paid supposedly a sixpence a week, which was about 5 cents. But for many of the people who were taken as part of the Stolen Generation, they've never ever even seen any of that money. So this policy was very much a part of a very much deliberate policy by the Australian governments at the time to actually, you know, breed out the Aboriginal population. And, for example, some of the horrendous things that could happen, there was various acts and laws passed, something like 600 pieces of legislation over different periods of time that try and define what it was to be Aboriginal or not to be Aboriginal. And through the actually 50s, 40s, 50s and 60s, if you were light enough skinned, you could apply for a pass which would actually exempt you from being black. So it would allow you more into wider communities, also allow you to seek certain forms of employment that you may not have been able to have if you were designated to be black. So it was quite horrendous policies. And what's happened, there's been a move over the last few years. Government commissions have looked into this particular thing and have said that, you know, this did take place. There needs to be some sort of compensation and apology to the stolen generations. Unfortunately, we have a very mean-spirited government in this country which refuses to do so, and there has been a campaign going for the last few years. Probably one thing just quickly I would like to point out, that for many Indigenous activists today, we still also view that there is still a stolen generation going on, in the sense of that, for example, there's legislation that's been passed in Australia known as mandatory sentencing, which means that many people are mandatorily sentenced for, just say, a first offence of stealing something like biscuits, and you can be jailed up to 2 weeks and 3 months, and then for a third offence, a year. I believe you have something like this, I think, in California.
Only in our country, it can be a life sentence.
Yes, yes, which is even worse. And so, unfortunately, this legislation is primarily in Northern Territory and Western Australia, which has a high level of Aboriginal population, and the main people affected by this law are Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. So we're losing a generation of youth now because of these particular racist legislation that has been passed by our government.
There is so much to talk about. We're going to talk more about the stolen generation next week, but you organized protests outside the Sydney Opera House when Prime Minister John Howard was to receive reconciliation documents. You got inside with a banner?
Yes, yes. Joel and myself and other members of the ISN, the Indigenous Student Network, we decided that we needed to bring a bit more radical politics into what was going on. And we, what we did around our campaign, we called it No Reconciliation Without Justice, meaning that you couldn't have reconciliation until Indigenous people had justice in this country. And Joel coordinated the rally that was outside, where people wore silenced banners across their faces. And I was able to get inside courtesy of a leading alternative newspaper in Australia, Green Left Weekly, who had managed to get media passes, and they offered it to us. And I was able to go in and waited until the strategic moment when the Prime Minister gave his speech, and then was able to jump up with a banner and that said No Reconciliation Without Justice, and also shout a number of slogans and demands that we were, and that sort of set the ball rolling of what everything else was happening in there, and other people started to do the same thing.
In the last minute that we have, you've gone from the traditional corroboree Aboriginal ceremony to the protest against multinationals, Nike, McDonald's. Can you describe it in 60 seconds?
Oh, dude, that's very hard. I suppose, like Damien, Joel and I were both at the WEF protests in Melbourne, and I suppose one of the things what we'd like to say is that, you know, Indigenous Australians are being affected by multinationals and corporations just as people in the third world are, because basically these companies are putting profits before people, and this affects not only people in the third world, but also Indigenous people and non-Indigenous people in Australia as well. And so we try to seek to make those links and show that, you know, this is a campaign that we all have to unite against to make sure that there is social justice for all people, black and white.
Is there a website people can go to get more information about these alternative events, these protests at the Sydney 2000 Olympics? Also give a chance of press to do some stories on what is happening.
Sure. There's one particular site called the Anti-Olympic Alliance. Unfortunately, I don't have
We'll put it on our website. And I want to thank you very much for being with us. Kim Bullimore, Aboriginal organizer, Joel Bray, both with the Indigenous Student Network, and Damien Lawson with the Western Suburbs Legal Centre in Melbourne. That does it for our show. The others speaking to us from Sydney, Australia, at the 2000 Summer Olympics. You can go to our website and get all the contact information, www.democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced by Jillian Aldrich and Sidrock Franklin. Special thanks to Deepa Fernandez, Robert Knight, Matthew Finch, our engineer. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for listening.